I'm Benjamin Ginsberg, and I'm the David Bernstein Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Matthew Crenson, and I'm a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins.
I'm Elizabeth Tracy. Welcome to this month's Great Ideas. Having the two of you here, of course, I know that there are going to be great ideas that are going to be presented this month. We're talking specifically about a couple of books you've both written. Can you just tell me a little bit more about those?
Well, there are two books that we wrote together, and then Ben wrote one by himself. The first one was published in 2002, and it was called Downsizing Democracy: How America Sidelined Its Citizens and Privatized Its Public. The second book is really a sequel to that one. That one tried to explain why the public in general is so disengaged from politics these days, much more so than they were in the past. And the second book, which is called Presidential Power Unchecked and Unbalanced, is about the impact that that fact has on the operation of government.
And the third book, which I wrote all by myself, called The American Lie, is, in a way, my personal take on American politics and why political participation can be so dissatisfying and so disheartening to all of us.
And there's certainly a lot of objective evidence emerging that would substantiate all of these positions. I know for sure of surveys I've heard recently about undergraduates, for example, who never look at anything that's political in nature, really not engaged in the process whatsoever.
Well, that's right. We're always told that we need to be informed, involved, aware, that we need to participate. But the reality is that for most people, most of the time, participation is not particularly useful. Yeah. There are other pursuits that are more interesting. Personally, I like to go to the movies. I like to go dancing. I like to play tennis. I find these much more satisfying than politics. But it's not my fault. It's the fault of the politicians.
People need an incentive to participate. And the fact that people are disengaged now is quite different from what it was. For example, when we were in college, we had an incentive to be politically active precisely because of the draft. We were worried about going to Vietnam. But the government, the present administration, has restructured our military forces. So that's not a problem for most young men these days.
And so what it sounds like to me then is that at the time when you both were growing up and were involved in the political process, you had a vested interest, and that now there really isn't a vested interest represented for most of us.
That's true. And part of it is because we've reinvented warfare in a way that doesn't engage most of the citizens. But there are also a lot of other things that go on. For example, the use of the courts to settle policy questions. Interest groups, of which there are many more today than there were in the 1960s, use litigation very frequently to get what they want. But using litigation means they don't have to mobilize a public behind them to achieve their political objectives. They just hire a lawyer.
And sure, and they spend a lot of money doing
that. That's right. But that's another reason for political disengagement.
You know, every week or so I listen to the radio or watch television and discover that President Bush's popularity has plummeted to a new low. And some very learned commentator will explain that if President Bush's popularity falls even one more point, he'll probably be unable to govern. And I'm always taken aback by that. I'm sure President Bush wants to be liked, as we all do, but his popularity or lack thereof has no impact whatsoever on his ability to govern. President Bush controls armies and bureaucracies. That's how he governs. And ordinary folks like us have been factored out of the political process. Do you remember when President Bush gave his speech in the wake of 9/11? It was the call to the nation, the speech that was the equivalent of Churchill's speech about blood, sweat, tears and toil. Well, President Bush said we should go shopping. Do you remember this?
I don't remember. Yeah.
He said Americans should go shopping.
Well, he also said we should hug our children.
We should hug our children and go shopping. Well, I asked my wife whether she thought it would be more patriotic to go to Bloomingdale's or to Neiman's, and we settled on Neiman's. So as you can see, we did our part.
Right. But this is not just a George W. Bush problem. This is a problem that's inherent in the institution of the presidency. It's been developing for a very long time.
Right. And in fact, that was a point I was going to bring out. It seems to me that in listening to both of you talk even here, but also in taking a look at your books, one central hypothesis that seems to emerge is that this has all been a process. Much as your thought about this has been a process, so has the usurpation, if you will, of power from the people that now is invested in the executive branch.
Yeah. That's right.
And there are some very interesting manifestations of it. In fact, some just came into being in the last few months by executive order. For example, there's one executive order that says during a condition of national emergency, the president shall be the person who leads us toward constitutional government. This directly contravenes a piece of legislation passed in 1976, which says that when the president declares a state of emergency, Congress has the power to undeclare it. That's completely ignored now. Apparently, this executive order supersedes the legislation. Nobody said anything about it.
When we talk to people about the expansion of presidential power in recent decades, most Americans are utterly unaware of the extent to which presidents, and not just George Bush, but Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, all of our recent presidents, have developed the power to rule unilaterally. Presidents, for example, issue, as Matt just mentioned, thousands of executive orders. Now, an executive order is a presidential decree nominally based on some piece of legislation enacted by Congress, and this decree is enforceable by the courts. It's the law. Now, when the president issues such a decree, he will always say, pursuant to, and he'll name public law. But often the relationship between the decree and the underlying statute is very vague. So, for example, when President Clinton declared millions of acres of western land to be off limits to developers, he cited the National Monuments Act as the source of his power. This sent everyone in Washington scurrying to the statute books. No one had ever heard of this. Well, it turned out this had been enacted in the 19th century to protect Pike's Peak. And its relationship to the current situation was somewhat tenuous. And President Reagan created a new source of presidential power called regulatory review by executive order. His executive order was nominally based on the Paperwork Reduction Act. So this was a piece of legislation passed by Congress to say to small business people that they could file fewer forms. Well, President Reagan said one way to have them file fewer forms is for me to decide what forms need to be filed. So I am assuming the power of regulatory review. So any rules and regulations that bureaucratic agencies want to implement have to be passed by me first.
But this is only one part of the combination of circumstances that led to the enhancement of presidential power. We talk about three different things that have contributed to it. The same things you look at in a homicide case: motive, means, and opportunity. The motives of presidents have become much more ambitious over the past 60 or 70 years because the way we elect presidents has changed. In the past, a president would be a minor figure plucked from the middle ranks of his party by the party bosses. But now, instead of being propelled into the presidency by party organizations, presidents have to be self-propelled. And you can see that in the current campaign. Motives have changed. Ben has just been talking about the means, the use of executive orders. Maybe talk about signing statements. There are a variety of other things. And then there are the opportunities. The institutions that used to stand in the way of presidents have now declined, Congress in particular, which used to be held together and disciplined by political parties, where the leadership used to have a vested interest in the power of the institution itself. Well, now members of Congress are mostly interested in getting reelected, not in protecting the prerogatives of Congress. And so you have the motives, much more powerful than they used to be, the means, much more extensive than they used to be, and the openings. The obstacles have largely disappeared.
And so when you trace this, could you put your finger on a specific time at which you felt that these three motivations outweighed any of the other balances or checks that were in place?
There are building blocks going back early in the 20th century, but as in so many other things, the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt was one turning point. Franklin Roosevelt was not much interested in seeking the support of Congress when he didn't have to, so he preferred to govern through executive orders. Franklin Roosevelt also expanded the nation's bureaucracy, created the administrative state, which has become, in many ways, the major source of presidential power. Today, through a process called regulatory review, presidents issue orders to the bureaucracy, informing them of the president's regulatory agenda. Now, this regulatory agenda has become an ersatz legislative agenda. Presidents don't go to Congress with requests anymore. They do it themselves. For example, when President Clinton found that he could get nothing through Congress, which, as you may recall, was usually trying to impeach him, he decided the H-E-L-L with them, and he implemented much of his agenda through regulatory review. In fact, the entire Clinton environmental agenda, not one bit of which was voted into law by Congress, is the law of the land through the regulatory review process. When Clinton left office and Bush came in, the individual whom Bush had nominated to be head of an agency called OIRA, Office of Information and Regulatory Assessment, within the White House Office of Management and Budget. This is the agency primarily responsible for regulatory review. This individual met with Clinton's director, outgoing director of OIRA, and he said to her, you know, of course, our party has greatly criticized this regulatory review process. However, the president finds it fascinating, and he wanted me to meet with you to discuss how it's done. So they learned a lot about it. They've expanded it. I think we should be frightened. The character of our government has changed dramatically. Those same commentators who are busy worrying about every point in presidential popularity might point out the more important fact that the Democrats took control of Congress in 2006, pledging to undo Bush's war policies and other policies. And exactly what have they done? Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. They haven't found a way even of attacking the president's policies. All they can do is gripe from the sidelines. Well, hell, we can do that too.
Yeah. And we're pretty
and
good
we do,
at that.
Yes.
Right. And speaking of that, in your books, you emerge in your chronicling of this whole process almost as apologists for this situation. The question is, now what? It's okay to be an observer and to empirically say, this is what we've seen, but now what?
That's a difficult question. In fact, we get to the end of our books and we ask ourselves that very question. And the truth is, we don't have a very good answer. And the reason we don't is, although we can come up with lots of different reforms that would help to turn back the clock or make things better, we also realize that the people who have the authority to put those reforms into effect, in most cases, have absolutely no interest in doing so because they're served well by the present system.
I think that we Americans are always fond of believing that every problem has a solution. Constitutional government in America has taken a turn for the worse. Executive power has increased so much, and the ability of Congress or the courts to thwart executive power has diminished so much that I think it's too late. I think that we have entered a new governmental era. I was about to say for better or worse, but it's for worse, in which we have, I don't know what to call it, shall we call it presidential autocracy? Nothing short of a drastic kind of change is going to make any difference. It's not going to change when George W. Bush leaves office. The next president, be it Hillary Rodham, Barack Obama, or whoever, the next president will cheerfully seize all the instruments of presidential power used by George Bush and add some of their own.
It sounds an awful lot like the trilogy of the ring, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's the Dark Lord, and regardless of who's wielding the ring, that power is going to corrupt.
That's right. Well, we don't have a Frodo.
Well, on this, as in many other issues, we take somewhat different positions. And in fact, it may be apparent that we have very different political persuasions. I'm not an optimist by nature, but I know that it will take something very drastic to change this circumstance. But if we look back over American history, we've seen a lot of drastic things have happened. And although it's a bit frightening, it may be that the change will come when a president, maybe this president, maybe a future president, makes some mistake so awful that people are just forced to rise up and become politically active. Woodrow Wilson, when he was a graduate student at Johns Hopkins, wrote his doctoral dissertation on congressional government. And if there's an objective, I think that's what we need to get back to. Congress is very unpopular with the American people. They see a bunch of political operators. But Congress has one virtue that presidents don't. Congress is made up of two parties, and discussion is likely to cover a wider range of options in Congress. The presidency is one party, and I think we can see in recent decision-making that one-party discussion tends to lead to bad policies. It tends to magnify mistakes. I think we need to return to the empowerment of Congress. How that's going to happen, I really can't explain, but as an objective, I think that's where we need to go.
If I had to summarize the discussion, I would say that two very important trends have coalesced in the United States. One is the decline of citizenship. Americans don't participate in the numbers or in the same way that they participated in prior centuries in our country. Another important trend related to the first is the expansion of executive power relative to the power of representative institutions. And the two trends go together because the empowerment of the presidency is facilitated by the decline of participation. The framers of the Constitution said that the power of Congress was based on what they called popularity, by which they didn't mean the Gallup poll. They meant the involvement of people, groups, forces. The executive, on the other hand, doesn't mind being popular but doesn't depend on it. If you imagined a different America, one in which ordinary folks were pretty much factored out of the process, what institutions would be served by that? Well, Congress would be diminished. The president wouldn't care, because the president governs through armies and bureaucracies. And that's what we've moved toward, a politics in which ordinary folks don't play much of a role and in which the president with his armies and bureaucracies does. Now, in my view, that's bad for a lot of reasons. It's bad for our souls. Bad for our psyches. It's also bad for the country. And it's bad because, as Matt said, the president is not only one party, he's one person. And when we're run by one person who doesn't consult or only consults Dick Cheney, decisions are based on a very narrow set of factors. Lots of things are forgotten. Lots of things are left out. Ideas that should have been aired are declared to be off the table. So in the Congress, people talk too much. Every dumb idea is discussed, but that's good. A variety of viewpoints, perspectives, and ideas are out on the table where they should be.
So even though we start out at very different positions, we wind up at essentially the same conclusion.
Very good. And I would thank both of you for joining me.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.